Views expressed are not endorsed by the United States Department of Defense or its components.
Welcome back to the Flyover Podcast as part of USAFA Aviation. Today we have with us Major Mark Mack Griffin. Major Griffin is currently stationed at the 557th Flying Training Squadron at Davis Airfield here at the Air Force Academy. Previously, he was a CV-22 instructor at the 20th Special Operations Squadron, Air Force Special Operations Command Cannon Air Force Base, Clovis, New Mexico. He supports the 27th Operations Wing mission, supporting U.S. SOCOM operations worldwide. Major Griffin attended Amarillo High School in Texas, and upon graduating, he attended the United States Air Force Academy with the class of 2012 out of Squadron 15, the War Eagles.
Upon graduating, Major Griffin attended undergraduate pilot training at Vance Air Force Base, Oklahoma. After completing pilot training, Major Griffin was assigned to the 71st Special Operations Squadron at Kirtland Air Force Base, New Mexico, for training as a CV-22B pilot in June of 2014. Upon graduation of the CV-22B initial qualification course in 2015, Major Griffin was assigned to the 8th Special Operations Squadron at Hurlburt Field, Florida, as a CV-22B mission pilot. Major Griffin was then assigned to the 20th SOS Clovis Air Force Base, New Mexico, in May of 2020. While assigned to the 8th SOS, he was deployed to Afghanistan, Africa, and Iraq in support of Operations Observant Compass, Enduring Freedom, and Freedom Sentinel. Today, Major Griffin flies at the 557th Flying Training Squadron out of Davis Airfield, and he works with cadets as a powered flight instructor and introduces them to the world of flying.
Well, sir, thank you so much for being here.
You know everything about me now.
Sir, we're really excited to have you. And so let's jump right into it.
Let's do it, man.
What is a day-to-day deployment like with the CV-22?
Oh, man, a day-to-day deployment. Well, it definitely changes. So starting out in Africa, it's interesting, actually. So in Air Force Special Operations Command, when I first got to my unit, it might be a little bit different maybe than how some other airframes do it, but for us, we really cut our teeth by doing non-flying deployments. It might have changed a little bit now in the community. But what I did for my first deployment was I actually went to Africa. So I was deployed to it. Well, this is how I'll kind of tell you how it all went down first. So I go into my squadron commander's office and he tells me, it's like, congratulations, you're going to deploy to Germany. And I was like, oh, man, that's a pretty good deal. Like for my first deployment, going to Europe. Spangdahl, I'm like, this is gonna be a great time. Well, like, fast forward, I get there. It's winter at the time in Germany, so I've packed all my bags for a very cold German winter. And I arrive and I check into the GSOIC at the time, and they tell me, they're like, hey man, welcome, but tomorrow you're gonna be on the first plane out to Africa, Entebbe, Uganda. And I've got two bags full of winter clothes for Germany. So it was a pretty interesting experience, man. But I get out to Entebbe, Uganda. It's a ground deployment. I was a LNO out there for them, which basically is just, it was pretty awesome. I was a second lieutenant, about to promote to a first lieutenant at the time. And it was just me out with Operation Detachment Bravo and ODB. And I was a part of that elephant. I was basically the Air Force LNO to them. And I controlled basically all of the contract airfare that was out in the specific region that we were in. So if you think about it, as a first lieutenant, man, I was basically these ODB guys were coming to me and were like, I'm sorry, ODA guys were coming to me and the ODB element. And we're asking like, hey, can we do this? Can we fly? Can we use the helicopters to do this? And I'm like, first lieutenant. And I'm like, yeah, we either have the hours or we don't, So it was a lot of autonomy, a lot of leadership early on for me. And I think that is a lot of the reason why AFSOC does it that way, right? They kind of get you right into the leadership aspect of things. So then fast forward to Iraq when I'm on my first deployment, a lot of it and a lot of the way that the CV-22 does it is as a young co-pilot, you're really there to learn, right? So we do everything from direct action missions to log runs, which is just, logistics runs back and forth between point A to point B. We do, obviously the mission is infill expo resupply of special operations forces. And that's normally done under, one period of darkness is the way that we like to operate. However, whatever you're called on to do in a deployed environment, you know, is what you're there to do. So, as a co-pilot, you know, my first flying deployment in Iraq, oh man, dude, it was quite the experience. It would be, you know, we would be as co-pilots planning every day, routes, looking at, you know, different conflicts that could be out there, flying low level, being exposed to, you know, small arms, AAA, stuff like that, making sure our routes are deconflicted with that. And then, yeah, going back and forth and whatever they need for us. I mean, the difference in like a standard logistics run on a day-to-day, meaning like we're going from this point to this point and we're dropping off just either people that need to talk with other people, like key leadership engagements, stuff like that. So if you have U.S. forces at the time that are working with different Iraqi forces, talking about, you know, just relationships between those guys, they need to get from point A to point B. They're not going to drive the whole way there, right? You know, some of these places are pretty geographically located, so we'll do that. Moving bullets and beans around theater to facilitate what everybody needs at outstations. And then you have times where it's, you know, you're getting called upon to be direct action missions, which is pretty cool. Some of the neatest things that I've gotten to do, the CV-22, obviously one of its most advantageous aspects, if you will, especially when you start to talk to joint players, is its speed and agility, right? So you have definitely other helicopters that can get into different areas and maybe smaller HLZs and stuff like that. But the one thing that we have on our side is speed. Right, so we can get you from point A to point B. And really, the way that translates a lot for the ground force and the ground force commanders is, you know, if somebody's to get hurt, right? Their time that you can get them from the X or from, you know, one position to another place where they can get, you know, care is crucial for them. And so that's actually where we found ourselves a lot in the roles and in some of the missions that I was part of. How that looks for us is, I don't know how much I can talk about in terms of, you know, like classified stuff, but from a standpoint of how we would stage, we would work with the Joint Medical Augmentation Unit. I don't know if you guys have heard that term or talked about it. It's basically a group of medical experts that we would have on the back of the plane in order to immediately respond to the situation. And what that offered is, should somebody get hurt, you have this, you know, CASAVAC capability on the aircraft that allows you to respond to the situation. You know, maybe we're not the ones going to the X in the specific situation, but a lot of times those individuals get brought to us. We're in a location that's a lot closer than back at home station, forward staged, and then we are able to facilitate bringing those guys from point A to point B so they can get the care the quickest. Meanwhile, while they're on the plane for whatever duration, the individuals on the back of our aircraft are able to sustain them and give them the critical, a lot of times critical life-saving care that they need.
And so you mentioned a lot of roles there. How do you prepare for all that, both like training-wise and mentally?
Yeah, it's tough, man. So obviously, yeah, when you're being asked to do a lot, obviously it all comes back to how you train. And I mean, starting in Hurlburt, man, in CV-22s, I remember one of my squadron commanders on a typical training night, you know, we would do 6-hour sorties and you'd start out with a low level, which in Florida at times can be a little hard to find, you know, but we had our areas that we go to. But I mean, with having such a versatile aircraft like the CV-22, you know, beyond just the, you know, be able to fly like an airplane and then land like a helicopter, we're doing things like night water hoist. We're doing just normal hoist. We're doing low and slows over water where you are basically 10 feet above the water at 10 knots and guys are kicking out boats out the back and jumping in the water. We do, MFF, military free fall as well. So on any given night, man, you could be training any of those things, you know, and most of it's going to be your bread and butter is going to be on MVGs. At night, we'd hit a low level, we'd pop up, we'd do some military free fall. And really the best way to train is to simulate it with what we call full mission profiles. Are you guys familiar with that? Is anybody else kind of FMPs?
You can go through it.
Yeah, okay. So a full mission profile is basically, you know, especially when you're at a big wing like the 1 South, the 1st Special Operations Wing in Hurlburt, or the 27 South, 27 Special Operations Wing in Cannon, like you're working and you constantly have joint players that are rolling into those bases. You have big ranges that are out there that draw people in because they want to do operations in there. I mean, you have the 7 Special Forces group that's out there that we work with as well. So you have a lot of different people convening on one location in order to accomplish, all the training that they need to. So a full mission profile is when you get multiple players. And then you're talking about AC-130 gunship, U-28, CV-22s, ground users, whether it's the 2-3 STS out there, Crostos on the back, doing some type of personnel recovery mission or something like that. We'll get together and we'll all kind of come up with a plan that we want to simulate, right? And it's normally geared towards especially the way that they have the structure set up now, where you have a specific point in your cycle where you're training, you're in the training and the readiness phase, and everything that you're doing is geared toward the deployed environment that you're going to go into. So Afghanistan, Iraq, a lot of counterinsurgency type stuff. But the cool thing was, we would go on TDYs, we would go to MLATs, multilateral missions, where you're working with everything from C-17s, C-130s, and different MAJ comms to CV-22s, ground users, 75th Ranger Regiment, people like that, where you're practicing a specific type of operation that you could utilize later on in the deployed environment. And you're doing it, more importantly, with the guys that you're going to be downrange with, right? So a lot of times the coolest thing for us with CV-22s, that is just a little bit different than other aircrafts, is you get to develop a relationship with some of those ground users, some of those guys that are the operators on the ground, that for all intents and purposes, that's the reason why our mission exists, right? We're out there to facilitate what they need. So you're saying, what does that preparation look like? Well, a lot of times it looks like us sitting down, and the way that we would plan is we would work our way back from the objective area. So what that looks like is, there's so much that goes into it, especially we have, like other airframes and communities, we have flight leads that will lead the formation, right? Because you're rarely ever going to go out in a single ship, especially a part of one of these operations. So they're sitting down with the ground users, normally the ground force commander. And what that looks like is the ground force commander has an objective and they have, tasks that they want to do on that objective. So whether it's, capture kill mission, or it's something where they have to go and look at something, or they're trying to see if somebody's there, you're going to look at that objective. And the first thing that I, as a aviator and a CV-22 pilot want to, explore is where can I land around there? Right. That's one of those primary things. And then you work your way out from there. And one of the most difficult things, and certainly one of the things that I struggled with as an aviator in the CV-22 early on, was contingencies, right? So you'll start by talking to the ground force commander and saying, hey, man, like, how many people do you want to get on the objective, right? That's a big thing for them, right? There's security in numbers. I'm not going to delve too much into how they do their tactics because I'm, not one of them. But that's a lot of where the conversation starts. And then what does that drive? How many CV-22s I got to bring to the fight, right? And then a lot of that is predicated on how many we have downrange. So if you've got 4 CV-22s, based off of, how things are going with maintenance and just phase flow and how you're operating, it becomes a discussion with the mission commander of how many planes can I offer. So really, all of that is things that we try to practice home station. Like as co-pilots, I'm planning missions, and setting things up where I'm like, hey, I've got the flight engineers right next to me. We're running gross weight and we're saying, okay, well, the team needs to bring in 24 dudes. How many CV-22s is that going to take? And it's like, well, okay, great. They want 24 dudes, but can I actually land in this spot? That's a gross weight issue. It depends on what the temperature is outside. Depends on what the fuel state I have. And more importantly, like, where am I going next, right? Can I get fuel at the next spot? A lot of those guys want you to loiter in that area for a while. The first thing that they're going to ask is like, well, what if we, because, right, what's the most important time for any of these ground users? It's when they initially conduct the assault, right? That's when they're going to take casualties. That's when something could happen. So they want you just bugging out, right? They want you around. So you're going to need to give them a loiter time. A lot of times, tactically, we'll carry a quick reaction force on board that'll allow them to, you know, if they're overwhelmed, if they meet a force that they weren't prepared to, maybe necessarily, then we can insert those guys kind of like immediately. So you can see, like, as we start to build that picture, there's a lot of things that go into it. And the best, we try our best home station to simulate that environment. That looks like working with, you know, the guys that you're going to go downrange with, but also just anyone that you have in the area. And every single night, you know, taking that training seriously, working towards all of the mission profiles that you can be asked to do. Makes sense.
That's awesome.
And you touched on this a little bit.
Yeah.
So what, given all of these different missions that you guys are a part of, what is the enlisted force structure kind of supporting that mission? It, that must be so varied.
Man, our enlisted force structure is by far like the backbone of the organization, man. So primarily, you know, they have their hands in everything, right? So you're going to have just like a flight lead is going to be there. So that would be, you know, use myself for this example. You know, I'm directly interfacing with the ground force commander. My lead engineer is going to be right there with me, right? He's going to be talking through getting all the numbers, getting all the specifics, getting all of the information, and then running numbers, trying to figure out and you know, to frame that for what that means. It's kind of like what we were talking about before. You know, a typical fixed wing aircraft, and this is generalizing, so don't take this too far, but you're going runway to runway. Now, there's a lot of aircraft in the Air Force inventory, especially in FSOC, that don't have to go runway to runway, but they're not landing on HLZs like a helicopter, and that's kind of the point that I'm trying to paint here. When you're doing that, it's different things come into play. So you're having to think about, you know, the temperature outside, the gross weight they have on aircraft, which includes the fuel that you've got, the next location that you're going to, and what the actual mission, you know, needs. And then you're constantly having conversations with the ground users about trade-offs there. Well, I can give you 5 more minutes in the objective area, but that's one less guy, right? And so you're having to constantly have those conversations. But I mean, like public math, you know, if you haven't talked to aviators about that before, it's tough. So I got my lead flight engineer right there backing me up, right? Making sure I don't commit to things or oversell things. And they've got their whizzes with that kind of stuff. Yeah. And then we have 50 cal on the back of the aircraft that they operate. They're also primarily responsible for getting people on and off the aircraft. You know, when you land in an objective area, that's not normally, especially with some of the direct action missions that we're doing, not a place that you want to spend very long, right? So they're putting down the gate. They're making sure everybody gets off, you know, and then more importantly, they're making sure everybody gets back on, right? Or the right number of people are getting back on. I mean, like, they're a seamlessly integrated part of the crew, and they're a part of every single aspect of what we do, man. I mean, from when we're flying low altitude on the radar, you know, the CV-22, for all intents and purposes, is an aircraft that is geared to be able to fly 00 outside. Right now, there's an inherent level of risk that you accept with doing that, but we have a radar on there that basically uses advanced low altitude tactics and can ride us all the way down to whatever set clearance plane we have on there, and it's pretty low. So during those operations, though, we have, you know, I'm looking outside, you know, the engineer or being all I can be is a pilot to fly, and the engineer is keeping you updated on what your altitude is, time to target, everything, right? Does that kind of frame it for you a little bit?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
All right, so kind of like shifting topics a little bit.
Yeah.
It's kind of a touchy subject, but there's lots of reports about the, you know, the Osprey being a little bit unreliable. Yeah, like,
of course you guys are going to bring this up.
Sorry. We have to. We wouldn't be doing our jobs we didn't.
That's fair.
How do you
kind of... The viewers want to know.
How do you kind of respond to that claim and those kind of pressures?
It's erroneous. Have you seen Wedding Crashers? Erroneous. No, I'm just kidding. No, man. I mean, so what you have to understand with any type of aircraft, and this is, the way I like to frame it, is like when you're redefining the way that we understand flight, there's going to be some growing pains, right? So the CV-22, like I said, is a one of a kind. Now, I mean, the technology is kept catching on, and there's some commercial variants that are coming out there, AW609. And I'm drawing a blank right now on what the military is developing right now. But the Army, I mean. But point is, like, it's not going to be the only one of its kind for a while. But when you're doing that, you're going to have some things. So the best way from a engineering standpoint, you know, that I can explain it and maybe break it down for you guys, it's just like there's a lot of vibrations that go through that thing, right? So whenever and the other thing is, you know, fixed wing aircraft, man, you're predominantly like those things ain't moving, right? All of that movement in there and all of the, you know, the vibrations and things like that can create maintenance difficulties over time. But the important thing to realize is that like the CV-22, when you look at the actual statistical data, does not have that bad of a maintenance record when you put it up against some other airframes out there that a lot of people aren't talking about as much, you know, or at least like seems like they don't get as much airtime. I mean, we're in a different world now, right? There's a lot of different things that are driving narratives out there. But the CV-22, I mean, it's an extremely reliable aircraft. We have triple redundancies built into everything without deep diving all the systems here for you, which is probably not going to be in the short, you know. But just understand there's wild redundancies in there. But it has its difficulties, man, you know, and I can tell you, I flew the aircraft for almost a decade, you know, 9 years, and never had anything that I would consider like a catastrophic type thing. Okay. Yeah. And like, certainly when those type of things happen, because the gravity of what happens with it and what has resulted, I understand, you know, why people are asking questions and why those questions have to be answered. But my overall take on it is extremely reliable aircraft. And I think when you really look at the data that's behind it, you compare it to some of the troubles other airframes have had and things like that, it's pretty par for the course, if not even better than a lot of other ones. So
okay. I'd be concerned if there wasn't any problems. Just yeah. It was perfect, yeah, right, fair, off the,
yeah,
bat.
That's fair. Yeah, no, for
that's
sure.
That's valid.
No iteration.
So you kind of mentioned it like real quick, but you like they go up and down.
Yeah,
like,
man.
What's that like the first time you go from flying a traditional aircraft to, oh wait, these things move?
That's
like
a good question, man. It's a wild sensation for sure. So you take off, you know, we can do it a number of ways. Excuse me, sorry. We can do it a number of ways, but essentially, a standard VTOL takeoff is what we're doing, vertical takeoff and landing. You'll start out, you know, we kind of do like 87 nacelle. So you're looking at, it's not quite 90, but you're like 87 nacelle. You jump right out of there, man. And then almost immediately you're getting the nacelles moving forward. Now, the system itself has built-in flight control laws that will not allow you to exceed the operational capabilities of the aircraft or the operation limitations. So, you know, people have made mistakes in the past where you don't get enough. I mean, you guys know aerodynamics, right? I'm not a genius here, but you don't get enough speed over the wings. You know, it's not a good situation. So as you generate forward airspeed, then you can continue to roll those nacelles down. The cool thing is, you know, especially when you're egressing from an area, you can make this entire transition at 50 to 100 feet. So you're going from, yeah, you're going from 0 feet off the ground to, you know, at whatever we'll call it, zero knots to, you know, 200 knots, probably the span of 3 miles, and you've stayed at 50 to 100 feet that entire time. So it's pretty cool,
that's
man.
Insane.
It's pretty cool. And you know, like when you first do it, Just like you guys will be with flying, I'm sure you as a glider, you know, IP, you're a little bit hesitant, right? And then you get better, you get more, you know, proficient, and man, is that thing sweet when you get it, you know, just to that perfect, you can keep it at 50 to 75 feet, and you're just skimming, running. It's beautiful, dude. But as far as the transition, it's a lot more. It's interesting. I feel like a lot of people are kind of startled by it whenever the nacelles start to come forward, because the center of gravity that shifts around the moment of the aircraft is significant, right? And it's a bit interesting. Same thing as you're coming back, but it's really cool. You know, as cool as it is to be like going 0 knots to going 200 knots, it's just as cool to be going like 230 knots and then rolling back and landing within, you know, our typical profile is about 3 miles, and we'll come in at about 200 feet, at about 220 knots, and then we'll be at 0 knots and 3 miles, man, and just on the ground getting people out. You know, it's a wild feeling.
Yeah. So you mentioned like the distance you can do it in. How long does that take time wise?
Oof, man. I'd probably say, jeez, it depends once again, because it's all about what forward airspeed, but probably a minute, maybe 30 seconds to a minute. You're getting going out of there though really quick. And then, you know, it's all about how you fly it, so you can generate a little bit more forward airspeed depending on how you maneuver the aircraft. So, but yeah,
that's super cool.
That is a really cool airframe.
Yeah.
And so you've been on a couple deployments.
Yeah.
What mission has stood out most to you? What's something that when you think back on deployments and your Air Force career is something that you really want to pass on?
Man, there's a lot. I'm not going to lie. I have gotten is one of the coolest things. I'm going to digress here a little bit. This is how I talk. But one of the coolest things about the CV-22 when I first got into it and when I was in pilot training, which I'm assuming, you know, the aviation club, all you guys are headed that direction. But, it's tough to decide what aircraft I wanted to fly. And what came down to me was the mission of AFSOC. And I actually didn't know a lot about it at the time. I grew up in Amarillo, as you pronounce it.
Sorry.
That's the Spanish pronunciation, though. I grew up there, but there's the Bell factory out there, and they manufacture CB-22s out there. So I saw them flying around, you know, my head as a kid growing up. And when I kind of joined that up with the mission of AFSOC, which is just, you know, and it's such a cool, incredible impact that they're making out there. When I married that up, I knew that that was going to be the place I connected the most with. And then to see that kind of come into fruition from CV-22s, I mean, like, I'll sit here and tell you guys stories all day long, but being a part of direct action missions where we are, no kidding, going in and taking people that are threats to the United States and national security and taking them away from their humble abodes and then repurposing them in other locations, you know, like getting to do stuff like that. And then being a part of the retrograde of Afghanistan, right? I was one of the crews that got to rip the last CV-22s out of Afghanistan after, you know, 20 years. We weren't there for 20 years, but after, you know, being engaged in that conflict for 20 years, and then the personnel recovery mission that kind of we got tagged with afterwards, and then getting to be a critical part of that was pretty special, man. And I can dive into those if you want, or, you know.
Could you tell us a little bit about that evacuation? Kind of what was the role of the CV-22 in the withdrawal out of Afghanistan?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually pretty neat. So one of the fundamental factors that people were concerned about, especially, you know, higher leadership, whenever we were rolling out of Afghanistan, was the operational security of all the bases out there. So as you decrease the numbers and the presence that you have in those locations, that in a sense is going to drive a residual risk that those locations, and we still have Americans in those places, right? So we got to have a plan for that. A lot of what we were doing out there, CV-22s, was developing with the ground users that we were working with out there, how we could essentially facilitate a mass on force on one of those objectives should something happen, should, you know, the Taliban or one of those terrorist organizations decide that, like today, the level of American influence on that base is low enough to where they want to, you know, go do an assault on that location. And a lot of that was talking about, well, how would we respond? What does that response look like? How big does that package look like? I mean, we were, for all intents and purposes, there was a few other players out there in theater as well. But one of the only vertical lift assets that could facilitate that capability. So a lot of what you're going to do in a deployed environment is contingency planning, right? Being prepared. We're not going to call it the worst case scenario, but a myriad of different scenarios that could happen, and that was one of them. Now, as we drew down those locations, obviously that was done strategically in line with what how the leadership wanted it to go. So it was very short windows when that was existing, and then as we continue to draw down bases. that became less of a requirement for us, right? And then it throughout the entire thing, we were one of the only medical casualty evacuation like type of assets in theater. Now, once again, multiple other assets that the Air Force has. We have amazing aircraft that can do multiple different types of mission. But in terms of being in theater and able to respond quickly, we were always kind of on standby for that. And we had a pre-negotiated kind of response time with the ground force of when we would be airborne, which actually ended up playing out for me. I ended up having, we got the call one day, and we maintain what's called a alert posture during that time. So basically you just have guys that are the tagged crews for that day that are going to be on alert. And we got alerted that there was somebody gotten shot, unfortunately, and a gunshot wound to the face out in an area out to the north, probably about an hour away from us. Unfortunately, the nearest asset that could respond didn't have the capabilities in the sandstorm and some of the other things that were manifesting that day. So they sent us out there with a bunch of different other, obviously, assets on the back of the aircraft that can provide that life-saving care. And we were able to respond. We flew. My crew got called up. We were up in the air in about 30 minutes. Flew about an hour out there to the FOB, picked a guy up, immediately evac'd him back to the I think it was either roll two or roll three that was back in Kandahar where we were at, and got made it through, so
that's amazing.
That's pretty awesome, man. There's so many stories I could tell you in the CV-22 and in AFSOC where you get to see the direct impact of what you're doing out there, which was probably the most rewarding aspect for me. I mean, even when we retrograded out of, they eventually closed all the bases. They were, we had to get out of there as well to close down the spot that we were at. So we retrograded to another location in the Middle East. And even then, we're still, because there's manned assets over theater, we got tasked with a personnel recovery type of mission that was pretty cool to be able to develop. When you talk about, going from FMPs, in planning, I had buddies that I was in AFSOC with that I had worked with previously in MLATs and stuff like that, that I was then in operational theater in a deployed environment developing a personnel recovery mission with, that flew different airframes and stuff like that. And so it is no joke when we talk about going from a training environment, right, and training for the fight, to now we're in the operational environment, we're in Afghanistan, and we're being asked, captains and lieutenants being asked to come up with the personnel recovery mission for how we're going to rescue somebody if they go down in Afghanistan after the retrograde. So really cool type thing. And then, just being given that responsibility, working my way up in the CV-22 community to where people trusted me to be the face of people that could do that. My best friend, Nick Zimmerman, was the flight lead at the time. And it's like, me and him are there developing the plan with the ground users. And just, those are some of the best memories that I have. Some things that did happen, right, that were direct action type missions, and some things that you just planned for, that luckily never happened, but were still super rewarding experiences.
So you kind of talked about gaining that trust and getting further up in the community. What was that like becoming an instructor and kind of shifting your role a little bit in that sort of way?
Man, it's a grind, right? So you guys are, you get exposed to it for sure. The academy does a phenomenal job of preparing for you, instilling those principles of hard work, integrity, things like that. But, there's going to be some who do and some who don't. And a lot of that is predicated on how hard you're willing to work for it. So understanding your job is critical. Now, it is also fundamental for aircraft commanders and good leaders to define that for you. But getting to a flying unit early on, it's funny, I talk with all my the cadets that come down there, but a lot of it is just being willing to just kind of stay quiet and learn early on. it's not that you can't have an opinion, absolutely, but it's certainly like you're there to gain the experience of all the people that have come before you, right? And then through that, you're going to inevitably have some of your own stories, and you're going to learn through that. I've always been a guy who, unfortunately or fortunately, however you want to see it, has to learn from experience. Some guys can just nug it out in the books, right, and just have it like right away. Training was not like that for me. But I had a community that took care of me, man. And I had a community that looked after me every single step of the way from the time that I was at the 71st Special Operations Squadron. You know, you can have some good flights and some bad flights and pilot trains, but like I can tell you that right now, right? I did T6s and T38s. And how I got T38s, I still don't know, because T6s was not great, you know? But I mean, it was so much fun, but I did not do great. But CV-22 is the same thing, you know? It's always been a grind. It's always been something that I really had to devote myself to. But the Air Force rewards people that work hard, man, and have great work ethics and have great attitudes. So that's basically what I carried through all the way through, man. Getting selected to instructor pilot, this is one of the coolest things ever, you know. As a co-pilot, you're in receive mode, you know, kind of like I just talked about. Then you become an aircraft commander, and immediately it's on you, right? Like every decision, I'm a, you know, first lieutenant captain, and I'm flying around a $90 million aircraft, and it's like something happens out there, man. I can't call back. I mean, you can call back home at times, but not always. Point being is you've been empowered by the Air Force to make those decisions. And then, you know, you graduate from that aircraft commander role, you do your first MLAT, where you're like, you know, chalk 4 or whatever it is. In my situation, it was chalk 12 because we did this sweet. Jeez. Yeah, we did this sweet CV-22. We called it a tilt lat. It's typically an MLAT, but we used 12 CV-22s to assault the objective, which is one of the coolest things in American history. No, cool. It was awesome. And I was like chalk 6 for that or something like that. But it was a cool experience for me to have early on. And then to be an instructor, now you're the front line for the squadron commander, right? You're the one setting the standard. You're the one that's now, you know, you get young guys like you guys coming into the unit. And it's my responsibility for making you, training my replacement, right? Something I'm big on. Making you guys the next generation of CV-22 guys. So it's obviously a increased level of responsibility every single step that you take, but well worth it. Mm. Makes sense?
Yeah, for sure. So just to go back a little bit, you know, we've had people talk about fixed wing aircraft and how they fit into the Air Force. We've had people talk about how helos fit into the Air Force, right? Where does the, you know, CV-22 fall into that? And like, how do you guys plug and play with everyone?
Oh man. Well, it's kind of, you know, it really is like a jack of all trades kind of aircraft. But I guess to answer the question that you're kind of getting at is, would be, how do we integrate our aircraft into the overall air picture? And what that looks like a lot of times is on Air Force Special Operations Command types of mission. But I mean, I will default to what I kind of mentioned earlier, which is infill, exfill, resupply Special Operations Forces. So, you know, we always have this, as much as, you know, it sounds silly, maybe you have this tyranny of you got guys that are 60,000 feet or however far up, you know, and then you got guys that are 100 feet, and we're typically that 100 foot guy. But every step of the way, you have people doing their own thing. So I've been a part of missions where, you know, you have a U-28 that's doing surveillance, doing everything, other things over the top. We have AC-130 gunships that are doing, you know, pre-assault fires or are the main fire support asset on the objective area. You got UAVs that are in the area doing other things. You have, you know, just stacks and stacks of assets, which I'm sure some of these fighter guys have probably talked about being in the stack and stuff like that. Where we fit is at the bottom of the stack, I guess, is the best way to describe it, you know, because our primary mission, especially when it gets down to it, is infill, exfill. And so that looks like us bringing however many guys on the back of the aircraft to the objective to get done what they need to do, and then getting them out of there afterwards. And everybody else there is playing their role to support that a lot of times, especially in kind of the irregular warfare type missions that we've been in the past kind of 20 years.
Gotcha.
And so kind of shifting gears to the future of the Air Force, during the global war on terror, special operations were huge. I mean, they were used all over the place. Where do you see special operations and kind of the CV-22 taking a role in a near-peer conflict?
Oof, man, you guys should have gotten a weapons school graduating here if you want. No, I'm just joking. So I've been doing a lot of study here in like a master's class right now, Air Command and Staff College right now, and a lot of it is talking about the American way of war, but also inherent to that is the future of warfare as we see it and how America's going to play a role in that. I would say that the CV-22 mission in terms of employment will change significantly in terms of how we get through integrated air defense systems and stuff like that. Now, you know, our guys and the guys that are still in the community, guys that are weapons school graduates, you know, they're nugging it out on all that and they're doing an exceptional job. From an overall air picture of what I see, we could probably go back and forth about the idea of whether or not there's going to be a high-end conflict with one of these great power nations. A lot of stuff that I'm reading nowadays suggests that with all the gray zone conflict, hybrid warfare type things that you're seeing play out right now, which I'm sure you guys talk about in history classes, I would be surprised if a lot of it wasn't low-intensity type of things that are going on. And obviously, that lends to the special operations mission, right? That's where we thrive. We thrive in that irregular warfare type of thing. But make no mistake that in the next conflict with a near peer adversary, it's going to call upon all MAJ comms, and we do this in the joint environment already, but to integrate and synergistically, work across it, all platforms. Which we're upgrading capabilities, we're increasing the ability to do that with a number of different modern technological advances that, I'll be honest with you, I'm not really read into because I've been gone from the community for a little bit. But they're continuously making those advances in order to be able to do that. But, when it comes into integrated air defense systems, when it comes into a lot of the things that, a near-peer adversary like China has, it's going to be a combined effort. But I think that special operations, and I think that the CV-22 specifically, will still be critical for those low-intensity type of conflicts where maybe you don't want everybody to know exactly what you're doing. Does that make sense?
Gotcha.
That makes sense.
Gotcha. So you kind of mentioned it earlier, but the Army is kind of making their own variant, sort of similar to the CV-22.
Yes.
Do you ever see the Air Force adopting or updating the CV-22 in that sort of way?
Oh, man, that's a tough one. I genuinely don't know at this time, like what investment looks. I know that we've been briefed, that there's been a lot of technological advances into tilt rotor technology. So do I see the CV-22 being invested in and, being significantly altered? Maybe not. But I do see tilt rotor technology not going away. And I think that it's going to continue to probably gain traction to the extent that fiscal budgets allow, and obviously operational necessity dictates. So certainly I see that as kind of the future. I think that the CV-22 isn't going anywhere in terms of its operational effectiveness. But I do think that we're going to start to see some other things come online. And from what I understand, are already in development. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, that's great. And so you mentioned this earlier, but the advantages that the Osprey might have over a helicopter or a typical like fixed-wing aircraft, where do you see those advantages kind of being bolstered in the future? Like, what does the community really want to highlight about those advantages?
Oh, man. What does the community really want to highlight about those advantages? So I would say that I don't see the advantages of the CV-22 right now drastically changing in terms of, you know, this massive leap in technological innovation for the CV-22. I think that what it already brings to the fight is an incredible amount of agility, speed, like we were talking about before, multi-role missions, so being able to integrate. And I think, like, what will come about is, and what the CV-22 will offer, and hopefully, you know, continue to grow and progress. And what, you know, when I was in, you know, part of the community at the time, what we wanted people to always know was, number one, right, maintenance wise, it's a very redundant and reliable aircraft. And then the other side of it is, there's a lot of things that we can do, you know. We kind of talked about a few of them, but the list really goes on. And when you talk about being able to ingress into some of these, some of these environments that we'll have to in the future.
Dang. It's all good. It's all good. Take your time.
Sorry, I don't want to go right into the mic. So some of these environments that we'll have to go to in the future, it's going to be one of those critical assets. I mean, we train it all the time now, right, for the high-end fight, to be prepared to do that. So, certainly, the low level aspect of it, the speed aspect of it, the ability to have, you know, defensive countermeasures in that environment, to be able to integrate in with some other air players, will be, I think, one of the fundamental benefits of it. And then, you know, all the while being able to do that to some degree as stealthy as you can, you know, from Air Force Special Operations Command perspective. So, I don't know. Hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah. It's awesome. All right. Now, shifting more to your personal experience, right? What was the transition like from, you know, the operational community back here to the academy and flying with the 557s?
Oh, man, that's a good question. It's way different, but awesome in so many different ways. I think one of the coolest things that a leader or just an officer in the military, if they're given the opportunity to do, is to be able to come back to a place like the Air Force Academy and honestly do something like this, you know, share, you know, have conversations and be able to share some of the fundamental things that you've learned, you know, in the actual Air Force, especially in Air Force Special Operations Command. I mean, I know we got a few guys out here, guys and gals, but to be able to go into the Air Force, to first graduate from this institution, having been instilled in with the values that this institution, you know, gives out, and then to go into the Air Force to just get that whole perspective and learn from that, and then to be able to come back here is a super rewarding experience for sure. Now to be an AOC, you know, it's one of those things that I always, leaving the academy, I mean, we get it. I get it. You know, it's tough to be here. You're definitely going to go through some trials. You're going to be put through some hard circumstances, right? All of that, though, is to train you for what you're about to face, right, in the warfare environment and in the future. And then you get out there, you get to see it, you get to take those skills, you get to hunt them, you get to make them better. And then to come back here and impart that to the next generation, I think is not an opportunity that everybody gets. Certainly when you're in your flying unit and operationally in a MASHCOM, you get to affect, you know, that co-pilot, the next round of co-pilots that come in, the next generation of guys. But to start doing that here, I think is fundamental to y'all's success, the Air Force's success, and our ability to succeed overall as a military. You know, and to do that right now, to get to give you guys those tips, it's like, man, it's a really neat opportunity. So, and then, I mean, the areas that you can make an impact in this institution are endless. Like, you know, working out in the rugby team right now, being able to develop relationships with those guys. I learned a lot of just values and principles through playing sports growing up, playing football here and then playing rugby here, to be able to get back in that place, you know, or in that area. Is an awesome opportunity as well. So it's a change of pace for sure, man. I deployed seven or eight times in 7 or 8 years, you know, so it's a change of pace, but an incredible. And ultimately, the mission changes a little bit as well, right? I'm not flying, landing at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, after 6 hours on MVGs doing low levels and military free fall, but I am now taking up cadets, introducing them to the first time that they've ever flown, I don't know, anything in their entire lives a lot of times, and trying to get them motivated and inspired about being the next CV-22 guy or gal, hopefully, or any, you know, any airframe, which is for me, and you know, something that I'm really passionate about. So not necessarily carrying the same weight in terms of stress level. You know, I'm a little less stressed nowadays. I'm a little bit, things are a little bit slower pace, but for all the right reasons. Does that make sense?
Gotcha. Yeah.
You mentioned off camera, and you just mentioned a second ago, you're coming back as an air officer commanding of a cadet squadron.
Yeah.
What is one thing that you want cadets to take away from an interaction with you as an AOC?
One thing. Wow, man. I would say that probably one of the most important things that I think to take away, man, from an interaction with me or just like, you know, being in my squadron. I mean, I'm a big Jim Mattis fan. So, you know, one of the quotes that he has in his book, Call Sign Chaos, if you guys read that, is value initiative and aggressiveness above all. I'm a big, you know, one of the things that has been instilled very early on to me in AFSOC is accountability. And beyond that, it becomes about, and you guys have figured this out in your careers, the way that you distinguish yourself as an individual is being the person that's willing to put in the extra work, right? There is no replacement for hard work in life. And I don't know if everybody's learned that lesson. Maybe when they get here, I hadn't when I got to the academy, like full disclosure, you know? But when you look, you know, as a commander, I think, you know, I haven't been one yet, but as a leader, when you look at people and you start to kind of figure out how to motivate different individuals, how to impact people's lives, one of the most important things that I think a lesson that I could leave with somebody is that every single thing that you get into, give it 100%, right? Now when we talk about, you know, divided attention and all these different competing priorities and things like that, just make sure that you have your priorities in line and that what is important to you, you give that the full extent of what you can. And a lot of times that initiative and aggressiveness side will come out if you're putting your full heart into it. And there's so many different examples I can give you of different ways I've seen people go, but even beginning in UPT, just being willing to, like, you know, be the guy that's being willing to be there and study, being the guy that's willing to help the guy next to you, you know, study, seeing people around you that are maybe struggling, being that person that is willing to walk over there and help them out rather than, you know, just get out of there because it's been a long day. That initiative to do that, I don't think everybody has early on, but I think it's something that can be developed, and then aggressiveness, you know, especially in AFSOC, you're going to be a part of some missions that are going to really push you to your limits, you know, in anything in the Air Force, you're going to be asked to go to your absolute edge. Training yourself to be prepared for that is the only way that whenever you're in the environment, you're going to be ready for it. And if I can instill in the values of the cadets in my squadron, the ability to do that, to prepare them for what they're going to face, to instill them with the desire for initiative in anything that they do, and to aggressively pursue like what they want and what they see as important, then I think I've done my job, right?
That's awesome. Lesson. That's awesome.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
So we always close with the same question, and every single time, and you can kind of betray your aircraft here. You can kind of stick with it in many ways. But what is the best aircraft in the Air Force's inventory and why?
Oh, yeah, man. It's the CV-22 Osprey for sure, man. For all the reasons that we've talked about here. But, you know, when it you bring up an important discussion, I think, and I don't know if you guys talked this about this on previous podcasts or things like that, but whenever you guys are going into pilot training, my biggest recommendation to you is never go in there being like, gotta fly this aircraft. Like, it's all well and good and in line with the values that I just outlined here to be like, hey, man, I want to align myself. I want to do everything that I can. I want to work my hardest so that I'm in a position to get the airframe that I want. Does that make sense?
Yeah. That makes sense.
But don't go in there with this mentality of like, man, I'm going to be the next F-35, F-22 guys. Like, don't get me wrong, man. I know guys that do those things, and they're great dudes and great gals as well that are crushing it. And they love every moment of it. But not all of them went in there and were like, man, I'm going to do this. I will say for me, my personal journey, I had no idea what I wanted to fly when I went in to UPT. I didn't even know I wanted to fly when I came to the academy. It was something that kind of developed along the way. But I did know that if I went T-38s, I did T-6s and T-38s, and you know, I don't know the evolution of pilot training and how things are changing nowadays, but I did know that that opened up all doors for me. So when you guys go into pilot training, when you know, in anything, go into it with an open mind. Don't have this set like, hey, I've got to do this. For a multitude of reasons, not just because, oh man, you might not get it. I don't think that's the right mindset either. But I think it is important, especially with you guys getting all this information on all these different airframes out here, for you guys to really figure out, like, you know, what inspires me the most, right? What is that thing that will unlock that aggressiveness that we're talking about here, so that I will pursue it and give it everything I've got? And I just, you know, no offense to you guys, but it takes a little bit of flying to figure that out, you know? So CV-22 Osprey, I don't regret it for 1 minute. It was my number one out of UPT. It was what I wanted, but I didn't know that the whole time. And it really came down to the mission for me. That's what drove it all. The mission of AFSOC that I've been a part of for, I don't know, a decade now. So I encourage you guys to find what that is for you, because it's not the same for everybody.
Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you.
Yeah, man. That's hope you guys enjoyed it.
And for our viewers out there, if you'd like to check in, we have on Apple Podcasts and Spotify Podcasts. That's where our long-form content. And we also have a YouTube channel that all of our full-length episodes. And then on Instagram Reels and YouTube Shorts, we have our short-form clips. Thank you again, sir.
Thank you so much,
sir.
That's the podcast.
Thank you, guys.
Have a lovely day.